Hello and welcome to another episode from Supreme Bystander. Today we are going to have a conversation about freedom of religion. My name is Kara Gallagher.
And my name is Jim Cole.
And let's get started. This is in the context of a case this past week that was just heard in the Supreme Court called the Town of Greece versus Galloway. You want to talk a little bit about the case first to give some background?
All right, so the Town of Greece has had a practice since 1999 at the start of their town board meetings that they would invite local members of the community to address the board. This is practice has been commonly known as the Chaplain of the Month practice, because at the start of their chaplain of their monthly meeting, they have someone from the town. They allege that it's a non-discriminatory practice that people can put in to speak, except historically, most of the speakers, almost exclusively, have been speakers or practitioners of the Christian faith.
True. It was like around, I think, 1999, they started with, at these town board meetings, a policy of having a moment of silence, and then that's changed to add more specifically prayer that would be delivered over the board's public address system. So there's sort of this question about, you know, if you're present in the board meeting area, which is a public building, whether or not you're perhaps maybe a captive audience having to sit there and listen to a prayer, acknowledge the prayer. In some cases when they started off, they will, you know, ask people to stand. If it's a Catholic minister, we'll ask for the sort of, you know, public acknowledgement, the amen. And if you are not, let's say, a member of that faith, if you are an atheist or a Jew or anything different, that you would be sort of maybe forced to, or at least take part in some sort of religious practice or activity.
So Susan Galloway and Linda Stevens are two members of the community in the town of Greece in upstate New York, and they felt like this was a bias towards the Christian faith, since most of the speakers, almost exclusively, as we said before, were Christian. So they filed a lawsuit to stop this practice. Now, the town has held that it was non-discriminatory because they did not select specifically the message that was being delivered by the chaplains. So this is kind of the confrontation that we have. Was it a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, and we're questioning whether or not that Establishment Clause of the First Amendment is being violated or is not being violated in this in the town's practice.
So it sounds like, too, you know, I mean, there were efforts on the part of the town to you know, move away from some of these specifically Christian prayer givers, and that came only after the two ladies sort of brought to the attention that, you know, these were predominantly Christian prayers. So they, you know, if they hadn't asked, the question is whether or not they would have gotten anything else. And I think what, you know, they end up happening is a person of Jewish faith, a Wiccan, what was the other one? There was a third one, too, that wasn't sort of non-Christian. Okay, maybe something like that came in. And so, you know, we're talking about the majority on the whole, if you take kind of all of the prayers, are predominantly sectarian, predominantly Christian. And that's sort of the issue here, then, is do you have this captive audience? And so maybe what we should do is kind of go back and look at some of the previous cases, precedents.
This is a really good opportunity for teachers to use a case like this to talk about where, like we would probably do on a lot of these issues, is where has the court been, and that may give us an indication of where the court may go. So in something like this, in preparing a lesson, we might want to say, discuss this specific issue where the outcome has kind of a question mark there. And we could have students kind of take a look at previous cases to say, by using these previous cases, how might the court rule based upon precedent?
Right. And so you also kind of get the, you know, positions of the, you know, attorney for the petitioner and the attorney for the respondent and sort of the arguments that they made here. One of the first precedents that We hear the town of Greece mention has to do with Marsh versus Chambers. This is a 1983 case that comes out of Nebraska. Nebraska's legislature, their, you know, their sort of state government body, has a tradition of opening up its sessions with a what's called a non-sectarian prayer that was led by a state-employed chaplain. This case, the Supreme Court decides that the opening prayer tradition is constitutional because, in their opinion, it's a non-sectarian case. It's not necessarily endorsing a particular religion. And the, I think the most important part here is that the United States has had a long history of using prayer in government, including the United States Congress, which does open up their sessions with a chaplain, I think, who gives a prayer. So, you know, that's the question I have, you know, for you, and also that I would want to ask my students is, you know, to what extent is history a good argument to make about sort of anything in terms of what we look back on our previous practices, if history is a good argument for why we should continue to do something?
Well, history seems to be a good argument with the Supreme Court until it's no longer a good argument.
Yeah.
Because the Supreme Court gets to shape which pieces of history they'll use and which pieces of history they'll ignore. So in the Marsh v. Chambers case, you see a chaplain, not only is he saying a prayer, but he's being paid by the government to say a prayer. Chambers, Ernest Chambers, is a member of the legislature, and Marsh is actually the state treasurer. So he's the guy whose name is at the bottom of the check for the chaplain. So the town of Greece would say, hey, we don't go that far. We're not paying the chaplain or the prayer givers. We're just inviting a forum for people of multiple faiths or of no faith. So we're non-discriminatory. So that's their case.
I think like one of the sort of interesting things though about Marsh that could be it could influence or potentially shape the decision that comes out of Greece is it sounds as if there's some sort of almost more guidelines about how, you know, how exactly that prayer is going to be delivered. It's going, you know, almost like a it's not going to be pro-Christian and therefore sound as if it's endorsing. If Greece were to, you know, perhaps put together some sort of guidelines about the nature, I don't want to say content, because, you know, that gets a little challenging with First Amendment issues, but if there were some guidelines about how many Christian prayers were delivered and then how many non-Christian prayers would be delivered, perhaps maybe then that would be the remedy for this kind of case.
Well, I think that that argument, though, plays almost into, partly into the town's argument. They're saying, you know, we're not regulating what they're saying, so we haven't set up any guidelines, so what they're saying has nothing to do with the government. So basically they're saying if we give them a checklist of things to say, then we're discriminating against what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I think that's a pretty good argument. But in the Marsh versus Chambers case, in the Nebraska legislature case, some would argue, especially, you know, Susan Galloway and Linda Stevens, I'm sure would argue that there was a checklist. It was a non-denominational speech. There was no references to a specific religion. So that's why in Nebraska they were able to do that in front of the legislature. So in this case, you have two different circumstances. The petitioners, Galloway and Stevens, are saying that the guidelines would be acceptable if they're using Marsh versus Chambers as the standard.
Mm-hmm.
And the town of Greece is saying, if we set up guidelines, then we're telling them what to say about religion, and that's a violation as well.
Right. Well, there's also the issue, too, which if memory serves, Roberts brought this up in the oral arguments, whose responsibility is it to monitor this, you know, these guidelines? Is it who's going to come in and say, okay, you've violated this here. Are they going to do it preemptively? Do you have to bring in somebody to kind of look them over before they're delivered? You know, he does kind of go down, I guess, that sort of slippery slope argument. But no less, it sounds like something that is certainly doable. But, you know, of course, it depends on how it's done.
There's an opportunity here to do what happened in the famous flag salute cases.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first flag salute case, Gobitis versus Gobitis case, basically about the flag salute. The Gobitis case essentially said that it was not a violation of someone's prayer someone's religion in order to have them be subjected to the prayer, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
You would know this one better than I would, honestly.
So you had, well, the first of the two flag cases, the Barnett case and then the Gabaitis, the first one said that it was not a violation of someone's free exercise to make them salute the prayer. And then in the second case, only 3 years later, they said it's free speech to choose not to salute the flag. I think what this case may come down to, if Roberts holds any kind of key to this, he's asking who polices, essentially not a prayer, mm-hmm. but he's asking who polices speech.
Mm-hmm.
So since there is not a guideline set up, does this fall into the premise that we're inviting people from the town to have a moment to say what they want? Sure. Is that free speech or is that freedom of religion?
Mm-hmm.
If it's free speech, the standard is you cannot discriminate based on the message.
Right.
So in that particular case, the town of Greece would probably have a leg up if they went to that free speech standard instead of the freedom of religion.
True, potentially, yeah. So there's a couple other precedents to maybe get into here and mention that were cited. There's the County of Allegheny versus ACLU, which is a case in 1989. The two precedents we're going to talk about now, they are different, but they're related to this issue of the Establishment Clause. And in Allegheny, the Supreme Court rules that a city's holiday display is unconstitutional. They decided that the display of the, you know, the, I think it was a nativity scene, sort of, I guess, sidelined or affiliated the government with one specific faith, that being Christian faith. The court said that while history cannot legitimate practices and that demonstrate the government's allegiance to a particular sect or creed, so it's kind of like if we're going to do one, we've got to do them all. So to that extent, I think you can agree that it sounds like the town satisfies that in the sense that they're at least saying we want other groups and sects to come in. But from what I've done in my reading, it doesn't sound like they publicize that. It sounds like it's more or less, you know, sort of on the DL. If you happen to know that anyone is welcome and open to come in, you can, but that's not advertised. And so, you know, that's another issue there that I could see jamming up the town on that basis.
But if it wasn't advertised to people of other faiths, we'd have to look back and see, was it advertised to the Christian faiths? So if it wasn't advertised to anybody, and people that are just sitting at town hall meetings hear about this, and they tell their pastor about it or their priest, is that a violation by the government?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if there was an extensive outreach effort into the Christian community and not into the Jewish or the atheist or the Wiccan, whatever, you know, faith or non-faith you want to practice, you know, whose obligation is it to promote these types of venues? If there is selective promotion, then that would probably be an issue that would favor Galloway and Stevens. But if there's no outreach effort and it's just something that they say at the start of their legislative session, then, you know, who's responsible for outreach beyond the forum of the town board itself?
Right. I guess that is the question, is how they've done that outreach. Because honestly, if they're picking up the phone and essentially calling the same priest or the same chaplain, the same minister over and over again, because they can't start this town board meeting without something, well, you know, that's really, I think, going to be the distinguishing factor here. How exactly have they gone about getting out or soliciting to these other groups? Had not, you know, Galloway come in and, you know, said, listen, this is available, and they're still not contacting anybody other than the three times they did to bring in non-Christian speakers, you know, that could certainly come back to impact this decision here.
But Marsh might fall in line with that as well, because not only are they not outreaching
mm-hmm.
other faiths or people that don't practice a faith, since it's non-denominational, this person's on the payroll. So
sure.
Not only are they not looking, the government, through taxpayer funding, is paying somebody,
mm-hmm.
and they're not outreaching to non-believers or you know, people that question the existence of God.
Yeah,
they're not reaching out to atheists or agnostics. So there's you know, a big push and a pull of where this might go, but a lot of it falls into, you know, what is the government's role? Who monitors? Who has promotion? You know. I'm sure the town is not spending exhaustive amounts of money promoting
sure.
this type of...
Well, you can also make the point, too, that, you know, based on, I think, what are sort of the demographics of the community, I believe it is an overwhelmingly Christian community. I think you have minority percentages that are quite low of, you know, atheists, Jews, Muslims, et cetera. And so therefore, and maybe in the town's mind, they're thinking, you know, we are, this is what makes up the majority of our religious individuals. And this is, from what I can tell, a very religious town too, a religious community. There was the article in the Atlantic this past week, where they talked to, I think it was Susan Galloway, and she's received death threats over this, like anonymous notes about how, you know, you should find something better to do with your time. This is what our town is. This is what, you know, this is America. I mean, this is, you know, a perfect time to sort of throw in there. It is a very polarizing topic and discussion.
Right. Well, many of the issues that get to the Supreme Court are polarizing.
Sure.
And let's just hope that the Supreme Court is not swayed in their opinion based upon how a select group of people that, you know, it sounds like people that would make death threats, you know, are trying to subvert the law, but we shouldn't change the law because of their actions.
Sure, absolutely. So the last precedent to mention is this McCreary County versus ACLU, which is one of the more recent ones in 2005. There are three Kentucky counties that have the Ten Commandments displayed in, like, outside of their public schools and their courthouses. The Supreme Court rules that the displays violate the First Amendment because their purpose was to advance a religion, in this case, certainly Christianity. The court also noted that an outside observer would have concluded that the government was endorsing a particular religion. I don't know if you want to add anything about that specifically there. It just made me think of something else, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, with a fixed object attached to the side of a building, that may have a different connotation than a rotating, at least, potential for future speakers that to represent what you think.
There's more of a permanence to it than that. Yeah,
and
that seems like a definite endorsement then, too. You pay the money to get that, you know, sort of plaque or monument made.
There's no money allocated for this. It's just simply time, which, you know, is valuable. But, when the town is spending money on it and the town is putting it up, there seems to be an endorsement issue there.
Okay.
I just wanted to get some issue with the idea of endorsement. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that there can't be an endorsement. I mean, that's an interpretation that the court has had since the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
But the Constitution talks about establishing a religion, mm-hmm. and Galloway and Stevens are not saying that the town of Greece is creating a religion. And then the other clause dealing with religion in the First Amendment talks about the free exercise. So the town of Greece is also not prohibiting anybody from practicing the faith that they want to. So, I mean, a lot of this, the idea of endorsement, the word or even the connotation isn't even in the First Amendment. And then you also have the idea of once the court goes down the road of, hey, the government can't endorse or encourage religion, that's kind of what invites a lot of these cases to get to the court.
Sure, but no less an endorsement test is used when determining the constitutionality of a particular issue. And, you know, the endorsement test, that's one of the questions we have to ask here in this case is, you know, does it pass these tests, one of them being the endorsement test, which has been upheld. Lynch v. Donnelly, 1984, discusses the endorsement test, which says that government action is invalid if it creates a perception in the mind of a reasonable observer that the government is either endorsing or disapproving of a religion. That's one test there. I mean, clearly we do have that. Susan Galloway and Linda, what is her last name? Stevens. Both of these are reasonable observers. These are people who have to go, not just these two. There are other, and that's, I think, sort of the crux of the argument for the two respondents, is that, you know, people have to go to these town board meetings to do their day-to-day business, zoning passes, you know, there's other public issues that they need to address. In fact, I would argue that, you know, the average citizen probably has more close personal business to attend to with their town board meeting than, you know, they do with the Congress or any other sort of branch of government there. So no less, you know, they have to go and deal and interact with individuals where they have to sit through some sort of prayer. And that's their opinion, is that they are reasonable observers and government is endorsing a specific religion here with these prayers.
Right. So when we have this idea of the endorsement, which again is the whole test is set up by the Supreme Court. The test is set up by the Supreme Court because the Constitution doesn't mention anything about endorsement, as we mentioned. So once the Supreme Court sets a new bar, essentially, then we have to adhere to or follow whatever tests will come as a result of that bar that they've set. But in addition, in other cases, like in Board of Education versus Allen in 1968, they say we cannot discriminate, or Everson from 1947, dealing with the idea of school busing. Mm-hmm. They say we cannot, not only can we not discriminate based upon one faith or another, but we also can't prohibit one faith from doing something that other faiths are allowed to do as well. Yeah. So the court, while it may go towards these whole encouragement of religion or endorsement of religion, they also might say, hey, if everyone had an open door and the Christian faith took advantage of that open door, we're supposed to now bar them from that simply because they took advantage of an open door.
Right. Well, it makes me think of sort of the other tests, which you're right. You know, especially when we think about how we teach this to our students too, is the language of the Constitution is straightforward. However, the application of it is where the rubber hits the road. And so you have only the precedents and the tests to use as sort of the barometer of what happens next. But a test is not, you know, the letter of the law. Tests can change, as we've seen in many cases. And this could certainly be the next test to come out. But, you know, the issue that you just mentioned that made me think of was sort of this idea of coercion. The analogy you just used about, you know, if you open the door and let sort of those Christian or pro-Christian faiths speak sort of primarily or predominantly, or any other faith for that matter, are those individuals who are there being sort of coerced because you just, you know, you, so maybe it is, it just happens to be a lot of pro-Christian individuals who are giving these, you know, these speeches and these prayers, but is it in some way coercive? And that word coercion was brought up a few times in oral arguments here. So, and go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so the remedy, because if this is coercion, if it's, you know, we have to figure out, or the court obviously will have to figure out how do you remedy the coercion? Do you say, okay, now no one speaks? Or do you say, no, you have to have a certain percentage of other faiths? Do you have to have outreach to people? You know, so you didn't outreach to the Christian community and they took advantage of it. Do you now have to actively outreach to other communities? Does it become almost like a quota system of who's going to speak there? I mean, or do you just ban outright legislative prayer?
Well, the court's not going to do that. You know, I mean, they don't send, I think maybe that's one of the most misunderstood perceptions about the Supreme Court and the branch of government is that, you know, they have a question before them. They're only going to answer that question about whether or not, you know, this is constitutional, not, okay, here's how you go and remedy this. So it's fun for us to talk about the remedy, but, you know, they're not going to. They could strike down and say, or they could say that, you know, this does not, the town of Greece has violated the First Amendment, they can go forth and decide how to fix that themselves, which is, go ahead, what are you going to say?
But in their opinion, they're not just going to say, we strike it down. They're going to say, we strike it down because. Mm-hmm. And the because is going to be because there was insufficient outreach, because this percentage doesn't reflect this percentage. In the because, we're going to see what would be a remedy to the problem that they find with the practice, even if they don't.
Yeah, we likely will, especially in particular, I feel like Justice Scalia is going to be inclined to say, given how his opinions or dissents have been written, he seems to be, you know, the most likely to use a lot of history to support what he's having to say. And in some ways, I think the history that he is discussing is also ideas about remedies in that context for how they could go about it, depending on how they go in this case, of course. So I'm sorry, you were going to say
something? No, I was going to say, like, a case like this, as you mentioned before, is a really good teaching tool because everybody has an opinion about faith. Even if they're a non-follower, then they're an opinion for why they're a non-follower of any type of faith. So this may get to the heart. And I think in religious cases especially, since people have this predisposition in many places for separation of church and state, that they may think that they have an answer right away. Mm-hmm. And then when you start looking at the case history or previous cases, you start to figure out, it's not as straight a line as we tend to think.
Absolutely.
So it's a really good opportunity to have students understand the push and the pull of the mm-hmm. court into something that they feel, they think, they breathe.
Right. I agree. Yeah, absolutely. So let's maybe do a quick thing, a little on sort of the arguments that were made by Galloway, just a kind of a, you know, recap of those that I heard in some of the oral arguments. And if, you know, you want to chime in here, feel free to. The Galloway's attorneys made the argument that individuals are captive audiences in this kind of a setting, with the exception of four meetings that occurred right after the lawsuit was filed. The meetings in Greece have been led in prayer exclusively by Christian clergy. Often the clergy asks a captive audience to recite the Lord's Prayer in unison. Any reasonable person observing these meetings could conclude that the town is specifically endorsing Christianity and excluding other religions because you have such a small, you know, percentage of non-Christian prayers that have been given. The practice of prayer before the town board meetings is entirely different from the prayer traditionally delivered before Congress. In state and federal legislatures, the prayer is directed toward legislators, and members of the public are not present on the floor. They're separate. And as I said, the individuals who have to attend the town board meetings, they're participants. They do need to go there for things like zoning permits and business licenses. This amounts to potentially coercion to participate. And the feeling is like, if I don't stand up or, you know, acknowledge the prayer and an amen, is that going to jeopardize my ability to get this permit or this, you know, zoning pass or something like that? Because as much as, you know, we've sort of talked about the idea of free and open practice of religion and letting people believe what they want to believe, it is still polarizing and it is still one of those things that very much, I think, separates people from others if you don't practice. And based on what we've heard from Galloway in terms of the, you know, threats and such, it has affected her in a very, you know, adverse way. I don't know if you want to jump in on anything about the town of Greece here, because there are some points to be made about arguments for them.
No, you can do it.
Okay. So the prayers offered in the Greece for Greece before its town board meetings are no different in character than any of those of the traditional or respected invocations that have been past precedent, you know, in our nation's history. In Marsh versus Chambers, that opening legislative session with prayers does not violate the Establishment Clause. That was fairly clear-cut in the decision, and so that seems to be the best argument to support the town of Greece. They don't discriminate based on religion, even though they have had, you know, a small percentage of individuals come in and give the invocation, who are predominantly Christian. They have had Jewish, it's Baha'i, that's the one I had forgotten, and Wiccan adherents also have come in to give prayers at the town board meeting. And as we said, the Christian prayers dominate the meetings because they are a reflection of the demographic at large of the town people of Greece. And there is no one who is forced to participate. If they don't want to, you know, they argued up coercion. In fact, Scalia, I remember him making sort of a comment or, you know, maybe laughing about the idea that, you know, you don't have to stand up and nothing's going to happen to you if you don't stand up. You could just step out of the room. And I think for the most part, you know, the prayer happens at the very beginning and then it's not for another like 30 minutes before they start asking, you know, public members, okay, is anybody in here who wants to make a comment for the public record? Does anybody need to voice something about the zoning permit or anything like that? So for all intents and purposes, you could potentially come late and avoid the whole thing and not feel like you are in a captive audience situation. So I know you wanted to say a couple things about the connection to another great historic case, Engel versus Vitali. You want to connect to that?
Well, Engel versus Vitali provides another, you know, case that may that has come up in this particular case, mm-hmm. in that you do have a captive audience, and that is students, and they are you know, subjected to a school prayer written by the Board of Regents in New York State. In the 1950s into the 1960s, and the Supreme Court did strike that down in an 8-1 vote. So there are precedents that kind of work both ways, mm-hmm. like the ACLU Allegheny case that you had mentioned before. There's plenty of opportunities for teachers, like for us as teachers, to kind of sift through these precedents, introduce them to the students, have the students kind of critically think out how they would apply or wouldn't apply. And, you know, it's just a good exercise to get students to start thinking about, you know, how this history or these prior cases may affect future cases.
Right, which is why I think it is good, even though it's not a precedent that's mentioned in this particular, in Galloway. It wasn't brought in, you know, to the court in the oral arguments. I think it's still great for teachers because of that direct connection to kids. Kids are involved in this case. You know, it's asking the students to recognize their dependence upon God. That was explicit in the prayer. And sort of, you know, see the fallout from that decision there, where it's struck down. Actually, the vote count was 8-1, and Justice Stewart, who I feel like you had to do some research on Potter Stewart once upon a time when we were doing that, we were writing for CQ. He makes an interesting point that I thought is worth mentioning about the Establishment Clause, just to connect it back to Establishment Clause mentioned in the Galloway case. He says, he's the one, you know, dissenter who says, that the Establishment Clause was only meant to prohibit the establishment of a state-sponsored church, such as the Church of England, and not prohibit all types of government insolvent with religion. In particular, he found that the non-denominational nature of the prayer at the school and the absentee provision removed any constitutional challenges. So it'd be interesting to see if that comes up in any way in any of the opinions, dissents, etc.
This is in like what Justice Stewart said. This is a good opportunity also to talk to your students about textualism, where the theory that, hey, the words of the Constitution mean something beyond just the, you know, interpretation as it goes forward, how they're interpreted to mean different things that it doesn't quite say in the Constitution.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks so much for listening. Of course, we've got lots of other podcasts coming up, going on. And feel free to check out the website, www.supremebystander.com. That's Supreme Bystander with no E-R, or just no E at the end. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.